Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast series, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. And without further ado, let's get to today's episode. When most people hear the term the dynamic duo, they think about Batman and Robin, but the husband and wife couple I have with me today might just challenge them for that title. Rena Maycock is founder and CEO of Kilter, a technology startup developing child protection software for smartphones that detects and blocks cyberbullying, grooming, and suicide and self-harm in user-generated content on messaging apps and browsers. She started her career in advertising sales and went on to hold a variety of senior management and director roles in Sky Media, Sunshine, and was latterly CEO of iRadio Group. She was appointed the Commissioner of Taxation and Welfare and chairs the board of the Irish International Business Network. If that wasn't enough, she also writes a column for The Currency, but I won't hold that against her. In 2011, she co-founded Ireland's largest traditional market matchmaking company, Intro, with Fergal Harrington. Fergal Harrington, her husband, is the leading principal of that business now and also involved in Kilter. He's a regular media contributor on all things dating related. Recently, he found Combera, a hard kombucha, I don't know what that is, by the way, drinks company, which will be the first of its kind this side of the Atlantic, selling organic, vegan, low-calorie and gluten-free alcohol kombucha to meet the demand for better-for-you alcoholic beverages, which has already taken storm in the US. Fergal began his career as an estate agent with property firm Lisney before joining Sherry Fitz in 2007. Folks, you're very welcome to the podcast. I hope I got everything in there and haven't alienated anybody to start off.
No, you, bang on.
That's some intro. Thank you. Intro to intro.
CV.
Right. Let's kick it off in terms of, I think the best place to start is the first major commonality is obviously Intro matchmaking that you both set up. Mm. Tell us about the genesis of that and, you know, the development of it and where it is now and the fact that, Fergal, you're in mm-hmm. full control of it now and as Rena has moved on to the next new thing.
Indeed, indeed. Well, I suppose I should begin where we began, which is a while ago now at this stage. We were introduced by my brother. Rena and my brother Owen were very, very, very good friends. Not too good, I don't mean it like that. Okay. But they were good friends back in the day, and we were introduced following... Rena played some music of his on the radio stations that she worked with, and as a thank you gesture, she thought, okay, he thought I better get her a drink. Mm. And I do know that she is single, and I know that you're single, Fergal, so I'm going to introduce the two of you. So my brother basically introduced us the old school way back in the day. And we went out, we started, and we moved in very quickly. Things progressed very quickly, shall we say, because we were quite decisive and proactive, and we just sort of don't want to waste time. So I said, okay, hey, what about this? And then before you know it, we're walking, you know, the dogs in the local park, and Rena is saying, I'm just... hearing my friends and my colleagues and my family members saying how difficult it is to actually meet people. And wouldn't it be great to become the most, you know, exclusive, private, confidential matchmaking agency in the entire country?
Small plan, so.
Small, small, aim low. And then I said, yeah, okay. I was a little bit cynical of the whole idea and I didn't really know where she was going with it, but she has a vision. And then we were in Gibney's one night and Rena spotted this guy standing at the bar, clutching at pints. Little did she know, he was actually kind of trying to pluck up the courage to actually ask someone out. And she thought, geez, there's no reason why this guy should be on his own. I'd have plenty of friends for him. So then that was it. Game over. We just said, this has to begin. So we were both working, but we were both in areas that we weren't entirely delighted with. The property, as you know yourself, wasn't going too swimmingly. Mm-hmm. So we were fancy to change. So Intro was born, basically. And we had offices there over Café on Seine.
Yeah. Well, when we started, it was... 2010, 11, and everything was tanking. Advertising was tanking, property was tanking. And it was a really great time to set up a business. Previously, neither of us ever wanted to set up a business because, you know, we wanted some control, didn't want to be answering to boards of directors and all that kind of thing. We decided to set up Intro. But we were able to get premises very cheap, advertising very cheap, staff very cheap. Really great time to set up a business. And we, you know, truth be told, we wanted to set up something that was would play to our strengths. Both of us come from a sales background. We knew that we could leverage those skills to set up this services business. It was going to be low capex, if we want to get into the weeds on it. So we decided to do that part-time. Very quickly, the company was able to sustain us full-time so we could move on.
And then when did the decision come for you to kind of say, I have an itch, I need to scratch, I need to move on to something else?
It wasn't deliberate, Aidan, to be honest. You know, we were both happily going along with Intro. It was a growing business, you know, on average, growing 29% year on year, steady growth, lifestyle business. It was great. I suppose I wasn't really being challenged at the time. And then the idea for Kilter came along. It was around the time I was pregnant and I kept getting served the image of Alan Kurdi, the little Syrian boy that washed up on the beach in Turkey. And I wanted to find a filter so I could keep using social media without being served his image. And I looked around for a filter on Facebook and Twitter and I couldn't find one. And that's where the idea for a filter came along. So it was actually originally because I wanted to protect myself from images and stories I didn't want to see. So it just became really natural for me. I identified a problem in the market. And it's very difficult if you identify an area where there's a clear market need. And we never get any pushback on Kilter. When I sit down in front of a parent and I say, we're developing child protection software, blocks out cyberbullying, grooming, suicide and self-harm, they're like, take my money, quickly, take my money. So we knew that we had kind of hit on something that was going to have a really, really strong place in the market. It was going to disrupt the market and create a new one. So it's very difficult when you stumble upon a problem like that, where you have to kind of just say, if we build it, they'll come. And I just couldn't give it up. I couldn't let it go. That was 5 years ago.
Yeah, you raise an interesting point. We widen it out to kind of the general entrepreneurship idea. I think there's two types of entrepreneurs. There's the entrepreneur that goes, I'm an entrepreneur, I need to go find a business and I'm going to start it, right? And then there is not quite the accidental entrepreneur, but it's a person who sees a problem, knows what they can do as a solution, and it ends up being a business out of it, right? It sounds like in this case you're the accidental entrepreneur, right? That you found you didn't kind of have your mindset that, well, I'm going to be an entrepreneur and I'm going to do this.
No, and I suppose I never in my life expected that I would be called a matchmaker or someone who owns a matchmaking agency. I mean, I always loved sales. I was always in property and I love property, but I never imagined me doing this. But now I can't really imagine myself doing anything else because I've just become obsessed with it. And I still speak to people on a daily basis, 13 years on, and it doesn't get old. And because every conversation is slightly different. I mean, you can, there's types of personalities and characteristics that you can spot a mile off and you can see why, okay, this country has 1.55 million single people and 418,000 separated and divorced people. So there's a massive market. But there's an awful lot of areas whereby I needed to become this sort of authority on it and say, well, this is the reason why you're single. And this is why I think if you tweaked what you're doing, you may, you know, end up getting success. So I love and enjoy seeing people getting success and me being the reason why and us being the reason at Intro, why so many people are now in relationships. And that becomes very addictive when you see that feedback and you get that feedback. Because we in Ireland, you know, it's the typical thing is to not compliment or not, you know, say thank you too much. Like the attitude is, well, I paid for that service, I got it, and I'll just move on now. Whereas now we get a third of our business that comes through the door is word of mouth. Right. So they wouldn't necessarily shout it from the rooftop or say at the wedding, at the speeches that they met through Intro, but they will tell their people who could benefit from the service. And so that feedback just is, as I say, quite addictive, and it just breeds.
When you get into entrepreneurship, it becomes a bit intoxicating. Like Fergal would probably agree with me when I say both of us are unhirable at this stage. There's no way we could go back. You know, when I was in my 20s, I was an employee, a regular PAYE employee, and I always looked at business people and I thought, why on earth would anybody want the uncertainty and the risk of not being guaranteed a wage at the end of the month? Why would you want the sleepless nights? It just beggared belief for me. But then circumstances changed. You know, recession hit, the business changed that I was working in. My job changed. My environment just changed. And me as a human being, I changed. And I just, something in me switched. And I just wanted my own thing. I wanted agency. And I didn't mind if I could only pay myself a fraction of the wage I was being paid. I didn't mind if I wasn't guaranteed a wage. I didn't mind if, you know, if I had sleepless nights, as long as I had control. So something in me just changed and I never see a way back.
No, and you only have yourself to blame is the thing. If things don't go right, well then, oh, that's my fault. What did I do wrong? Am I willing to identify what I did wrong and change and adapt? Or am I going to just cry to my manager if I work in the normal job and then say, well, we'll move on so, and there's this HR issue then. Mm. It's only us. It's only myself and Rena. It's on our head and we have to just deal with it.
Yeah, but in both cases, the other difference is in both cases, the decision to be the entrepreneur kind of came as a result of the good product that you had, the opportunity that you saw for a business. Do you know what I mean? That is probably, in your case, the trigger.
Yeah.
And then you go, well, actually, you know what? Being my own boss wouldn't be such a bad thing.
True. Right?
So,
yeah.
So that's the difference, that you kind of go, well, here's a great product, or here's a great solution, or here's an idea I have. And you know what? I don't mind taking all of the perceived risks of being an entrepreneur because I have something I believe in, right? If, to take the step and go, I'm going to be an entrepreneur, now I've got to go and find something and sell it. There isn't that same belief in what you're doing.
It's the perfect storm, really. Yeah. It's the intersection of opportunity, circumstance, idea, potential. And once all that comes together, and it was the same thing when we came up with Kilter, you know, I was bored, I wasn't being challenged. It was an irresistible idea. It solved a societal issue. It was just irresistible. And that's why we pursued it. Same with Combera, our hard kombucha brand. Irresistible opportunity, market ripe for the taking, brilliant product.
Huge in the
great
US.
Great brand.
Just not here.
And as well, you know, Fergal has been running Intro now for 13 years, for the last five on his own. And the business hasn't changed all that much. And we've got a great team of nine in there now running it. So this opportunity has come again with the perfect storm again. Fergal's a bit bored with Intro. It kind of is running itself. It's a really healthy business, but it'd be nice for him to do something else. And then we've got this, you know, this great idea, this great market opportunity and all those things. So it's the perfect storm.
If you think about the role of it, and you guys are slightly different because there's a pair of you, but if you were to think of yourselves as individual entrepreneurs, right, and if you were to go out and start a business and you weren't a couple, you know, you've got to develop the product or service, you've got to raise the capital, you've got to manage the business, you've got to build the business, right? That's an awful lot of skill sets for one person to have, right? And there, I always see that there is this real problem in some entrepreneurs who think they need to be good at all of those four things, right? And the reality is you're never going to be good at all four. And it's finding that point where either you have a partner, in which case you go, well, actually, you know what, you're really good at the marketing, I'm really good at the operations side of it, and there's a natural kind of a mix that comes, right? But I can't see the really successful entrepreneurs are the ones who take control of everything or try to take control of everything and try to hold on to every facet that has to be arranged. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I mean, certainly for me, there's an element of I'm obsessed with control, and I try. And as an entrepreneur, when you're starting off a business, you have to be a skilled generalist. So you need to be a jack of all trades and a master at one or two. It was much easier for Fergal and I when we were starting Intro because I had experience of running other people's businesses. And Fergal is the best salesperson I've ever met and remains that way. I'm a close second, but he's better.
I agree with everything you said.
That's a backhanded compliment.
I'll take it. I'll take any compliment I can get after 14 years.
So our skill sets really did complement each other in that business. It was harder when we started Kilter because really Fergal couldn't take his shoulder away from the wheel with Intro because he was paying for the startup party for all this time. So I didn't get the benefit of his sales skills to help me along. And that's been a bit of a challenge, you know. But what you do is you just find a good team quite quickly that will believe in your mission. And if you're a good entrepreneur, you can sell your mission. And if you can't sell your mission, then you're not a good entrepreneur, in my view. So you can bring along people with you and help them help you with the dream. and come alongside so that you don't have to fill all the gaps from an expertise perspective.
The pressure, though, that was on Intro at times was quite immense, and I was feeling it, truth be told, over the years. But I always saw that this is totally worth it. This is not a fool's errand. This is not something that's going to be, oh, it didn't work. I always knew from how determined she is and how determined, and, you know, she doesn't let go, let go at all. And that determination in her is what instills an awful lot of confidence in everyone that she deals with. And that's why it was a no-brainer. You're not going to like, oh, I think maybe you should stop with the whole kilter thing. That was never ever came into anyone's head. And that's why I think we're a good team in that sense. We stay in our lane. Well, I stay in my lane. I feel my lane was Intro. And that's where I'm told to stay, so I stay there. But it kind of works. And I want her to fly and do her thing, and then I'll fly with my Canberra and we'll move on that way.
You mentioned the thing about bringing people along with you, right? And I have a really strong belief in this idea that if you want somebody who works with you to act like an owner of your business, you need to make them an owner of your business, right? And you can't kind of have people working hard and, you know, not having skin in the game. So
I couldn't agree with you more. And that's become much more of a populist practice than it used to be, thanks to Silicon Valley, really. I mean, share options started there. And in this overheated labour market, you do need to make share options available. So you do get to bring people along for the ride and they feel like they've got skin in the game, and your retention is, it's a really, really useful retention strategy. But I couldn't agree with you more. In order to get that loyalty from people, because, you know, our parents would have come from a generation where you stayed in a job for 30, 35 years and you, you know, you got incremental pay increases every kind of, you know, three or four if you were really, really, really super good at your job, basically not even in keeping with inflation. You can't run a successful business like that anymore. You know, you need to take people very seriously. You need to create an environment where they feel like they don't want to job hop and where they don't need to job hop to move up the ladder. I mean, how many times have we seen people that have to leave a job to go somewhere else for 3 years only to go back to that original job, only in a far more senior position, because in the first instance, they just weren't given the opportunities or they weren't recognised for their skills. And if you offer people stock options or equity in the business, then you kind of, you're already staking your claim as, I want your loyalty. I believe that you are really, really good at your job and I want you to stay.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had Gary McGann on a previous podcast and he said exactly the same. He said he never ever felt like he failed as a manager unless somebody left the company he was running and went to either a similar position or a worse position. He says if they went to a better position that I couldn't provide, he said absolutely great, because it's you know, they've reached their max that they can reach in my organization, but they haven't reached their max, so it's great to get them. And then hopefully, he says, you hope you get the boomerang and they come back into your business all the better as a result of that. The interesting one, I suppose, is working as a duo, right, and not just as business partners. Where does the business life end and the personal life start, or is there always,
this is tricky,
the dinner table, the board table?
This is tricky. You may need to break this up. Do you know what our problem is? We don't switch off, and that's not to say, oh, we never stop working, we're amazing. I don't mean that at all. It's just I literally, personally, never stop looking at emails. That's my big problem. I'm not great at compartmentalizing, and I should be, and I should be much better. And I always say I should be great at switching off at that time. But then, oh, the phone rings and there's a potential sale. And I'm always thinking of the potential sale, and I still get a buzz from getting my sale over the line. And then I'll always say to her when she comes back, when Rena comes back, okay, how did that go? How did this go? But it might be 10 o'clock at night when you're looking at whatever you're looking at. And then she's like, oh, I think we shouldn't talk about this now. Maybe we should do this tomorrow. But I just can't. I'm the type of person that I'm like a dog with a bone and I keep on gnawing away at it. And I'm like, but no, you could just have told me in that few seconds that you didn't tell me, you could have just told me what I wanted to know. And so she does try her best, God love her, to just say, no, let's just try and focus our attention on family life. Because, you know, when you've got two kids, 6 and 8, and they're, you know, requiring a load of your time, and then you're stuck talking in the kitchen about, you know, the revenue and that PAYE due and da-da-da-da-da. And then the kids are like, oh, money. And then I find the kids, they go into the office now on Grafton Street and they leave notes for the staff. And the last one Quinn just left was, don't take on bad people, only take on good people, okay? Question mark. And so he's learning now. But he's thinking, okay, did you not like that person on the phone there? Are you not going to take that person on? No, I said, no, I don't think they're the right fit. And so they're learning, and I kind of love that they're learning. So we can kind of, in family life, also teach a little bit of entrepreneurship and, you know, the value of money, because, you know, he loves his match attack cards. Yeah. And some of them are €50 per card. So I'm like, you can't just get these for no reason. So he's going to start... start washing cars in the next month to make his little bit of pocket money.
Yeah, like, in truth, when you are a husband and wife couple and you own businesses together, in good times, they are great times because you feed off each other's positivity and it's euphoric and things are wonderful and you don't mind talking about work until midnight. If there's any element of stress, and business just does come with quite a bit of stress, one of us might be stressed and the other one isn't, and we're dragging each other into a negative mindset because we're obviously, we're husband and wife, and it's each other's job to buoy our each other's spirits. But it's very difficult not to, it's very difficult to switch off. So it can be very stressful at times.
Yeah. Well, when it's a client facing job and you're dealing with the public, and in intro per se, it's completely emotive. It's so subjective. And what Mary thinks is acceptable, Bridie doesn't think is. Mm-hmm. And if Mary and John go out on a date, if John doesn't like Mary, but Mary loved him, and then she discovers that he didn't like her, then all hell breaks loose. So she needs a punch bag. Mm-hmm. So at times over the 13 years, when we weren't as careful about who we took on and who we did, if we needed to be so guarded about what we do and who we deal with. But sometimes people slip through the net and they cause, you know, drama.
Is it easier to have two separate, to be working on two separate projects rather than the same project?
No, because I don't think so, because that would be annoying for me to come home every day and say, here, this is what happened. And then she'll say, well, what do you mean by that? Like, that's totally acceptable that the person would have said that. And that would drive me insane. I'd be like, no, you need to understand this. This is not a normal job. A normal business.
Look, intro is a very hard job. 90% of the people that we take on at intro are lovely people, but there are a small few that soak up all of the oxygen in the room and they make it negative. And dealing with the public, anybody that's out there that deals with the public knows that it is a very, very difficult job, right? Mm-hmm. Look, I understand all that. And the big thing is, I suppose, for the last 5 years, and this will be true for any, specifically a tech startup where there is a long lead time to raising money. A lot of tech startups fail within 2 years, because ultimately what happens is there's a husband and wife team. Husband or wife has a great idea. They feel really passionate about it. Husband and wife sit down at the kitchen table and say, okay, you follow your dream. I'll continue earning the wage. I'll bear the brunt of the financial responsibility for the family. We'll forego the money you would have earned if you were continuing to do your job X, Y, or Z that you were doing. But within 2 years, if you haven't got funding, or if it's not paying, or if it's not looking like it's going to get funding, then let's agree that you're going to go back to work, and the family will stop having to make sacrifices. So for the last 5 years, because I'm a bit relentless, Fergal has been carrying that can. Mm. And this will be the same for every husband and wife entrepreneur team. There's one person that is carrying the can for the financial responsibility, and that is a very stressful situation. And the other person is trying to build the business. And that can have a toll on the relationship. So for the last 5 years, Fergal's been paying all the bills. Mm. So it's difficult when he's having a really bad day, or interest doing quite badly, or I've gone off swanning off and I'm speaking on a panel at, you know, an Enterprise Ireland thing or an IBEC thing, or, you know, networking, because that's a part of the job. But for Fergal, that would be great crack. Mm. But yet he's running
the trenches,
business.
In the trenches.
He's in the trenches running the business.
I do it again.
So that, you know, there's an inherent unfairness about that period in a business, in an entrepreneur's journey. And that can be very tricky for a husband and wife team. And you have to be very, very strong to be able to get through it.
I think it's when you're reliant on people, on other people, and when there's no clear end in sight, and you're hoping that Johnny comes back to you and he's going to invest in that.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, will he ever just give me, as Rena says, give me a fast no.
Yeah.
Stop messing around.
But like, I applied for Horizon 2020, the European program, and it has a statistical success rate of 1%, but it takes 4 person months to put these applications together. And I was writing these applications and I would be up on, I would be doing usually 20-hour days for about 6 weeks before to try and finish off the applications. And, you know, it would be this long wait. And invariably, we weren't successful. Eventually, we got the Disruptive Technology Innovation Fund, which is a kind of a version of that. But those few times that we applied for H2020, my soul would be destroyed because, you know, you're putting all this work and you get no payoff. Mm-hmm. And Fergal would be left then picking me up emotionally off the floor going, dust yourself off. Is it time to give Kilter up? And I'm going, wiping away tears going, no.
She's there with three laptops
time.
And it's 3 a.m. in the morning.
No surrender.
Yeah.
No. What do you, because you've done a few, you've started a few businesses now. What do you learn as a serial entrepreneur? That you know, do you take learnings from each one, or if there are very different businesses, there isn't necessarily a learning to take?
I think with the latest with Combera, it's taking on board and working with people who have already done something in that industry in the past, and not expecting, don't claim to be this arrogant sort of know-all, is really key. Not being too arrogant and just accepting help and assistance and picking the right people, as you say, to go along the journey with you, and also seek investment early on, really early on. I think that's the key thing for Combera.
Yeah, I mean, we had a business that we started and it failed. We tried to scale Intro, but Intro is a traditional matchmaking agency and it's not really scalable unless you either franchise it or we tried to take our learnings and put it into an online dating site. But both of us had experience with boards of directors that weren't the most positive. So we weren't willing to take investment on. And that business failed because we weren't willing to take investment on. So basically, we had a really unique selling point. It was a really good product, but we needed big bucks for commercialization, for marketing and trying to compete with the eHarmonies of the world and that kind of stuff. And we just weren't willing to do it. We'd rather, at that point, we would rather have tanked it, which we did. So the key learning, I suppose, is, like Furl says, if we need investment, take investment on early on, but also invest in the brand, you know. An awful lot of people see marketing as dead money. And I come from a background in radio advertising sales. So I know all that pain, but it's not dead money.
We would need millions to advertise to compete against all the mash.coms.
But you raise an interest point. You're almost like you're reading the questions here, in that how important is it for your capital investors to be aligned with you and your goals in the business? Because invariably, if they're not, You're just storing up trouble down the line.
Well, what I found from raising money with Kilter was that very quickly investors are really on top of their game and will know that they're not on board with what you have going. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll know what your lead time to market is. They'll know what your mission is. They'll know what your revenue projections are. They'll look into all of this. And if there's anything that doesn't fit their usual investment thesis, then they won't invest. Mm-hmm. I have found that investors are quite good at weeding out those opportunities and they will invest in what suits them and that's it. You get an awful lot of people now that are, they will stick to their lane. You know, for instance, property guys that made their money in the boom, developers, they want to invest in tech, but they want to invest in something that they understand. So they'll invest in prop tech.
Yeah.
You know, because they feel like they can bring something strategic. You, with MedTech, for instance, you get specialist investors that invest in medical device because they understand that if you're dealing with clinical trials, you're dealing with a 10 to 15 year lead time to market. Then you get people that only invest in software, B2B enterprise SaaS software, because 6 months, Bob's your uncle, you've got a V1 that you can launch to market. And it doesn't matter. It's not going to harm anyone. By V9, you'll have a perfect product, but at least you'll be generating revenue. So there are, most investors will pick a lane now, and because they understand it and they're familiar with it, maybe it worked out for them before, therefore they'll stay with that, that they're quite good at weeding out those opportunities.
But that said, even when that happens, you know, you will still come to times when, you know, your board or your investors, you have to manage your board or investors when things aren't going well.
Yeah.
And that's a key, that if you haven't been aligned from the start, or there was a perception of being aligned and suddenly you go, oh, actually, do you know what?
Or if they raised out at the beginning and then it ends up becoming true, told you so.
Yeah.
Hard to get back from.
Yeah, what I found with looking for investors was And what went against me in the kilter raise was that usually in software, people will say it always takes twice as long and costs twice as much. So I was careful, or I tried to be careful not to fall into that trap, so that when I was putting things in a deck or when I was putting figures into a business plan, I could stand over them and call them conservative, genuinely conservative. I could point to buffer periods in development runways where if there was an issue or an unknown occurred, that we had, you know, 6 months in which to fix that and get back on track for the roadmap. That didn't necessarily always do me much favours because, again, like that, we are a software product, but we're deep tech. So software investors generally like a 6 month runway to market. VCs prefer to fund commercialization, not R&D. So no matter how I dressed it up, I knew there was no point in lying about the lead time to market, because any tech DD person that they would wheel out would be able to look at this and say, that's deep tech. That's not going to get to market in 6 months or 12 months. That's going to be 2 years. So we needed to know that if you're an investor and you're getting into this, here's what we're going to do. It's realistic. It's not bulletproof, but it's as close as damage to a realistic lead time to market and as close as damage to a realistic budget to get there.
Two guests with two perspectives was always going to be difficult to fit into one episode, so please join us next time for part two of our discussion with Rena and Fergal on Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. Remember, if you enjoyed what you heard, please do like, share and subscribe, and thanks for listening.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.